Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Max Wilbert. He's a third-generation organizer who grew up in Seattle's post-WTO anti-globalization and undoing racism movement. He's a co-founder of the group Deep Green Resistance and a longtime board member of Fertile Ground, a small grassroots environmental nonprofit with no employees and no corporate funding. His first book, a collection of pro-feminist and environmental essays, was recently released. It's called We Choose to Speak and Other Essays. He's also the co-author of the forthcoming book, Bright Green Lies, with me and Lierre Keith, which looks at the problems with mainstream so-called solutions, such as solar panels, electric cars, recycling, and green cities. The book makes the case that these approaches fail to protect the planet and aim at protecting empire from the effects of peak oil and ecological collapse. Ugh. So first off, Max, thank you for being on the program. Second, for all of your wonderful work in the world.
Thanks, Derek. Great to be on again.
So today I'd like to talk about the Deep Green Resistance Direct Action Trainings. Can you say what they are and why they're necessary?
Sure. So we started putting on these trainings about 4 or 5 years ago now, and we've done half a dozen, perhaps a few more at this point. We came to the point, myself and some of the people I organize with in Deep Green Resistance, you know, we've been involved in all kinds of different struggles over the years. I participated in, you know, fighting the tar sands and fighting various pipelines and fighting logging projects and water extraction and all sorts of different things, police brutality. And part of the trouble that you run into so often is that people try to achieve their goals using really indirect means. And I think the government and corporations and the society in general tries to channel us into these indirect methods of change. We're taught to, when we want something, when we want to change something in the world, we're taught to ask politicians to do it for us, and we're trained to sign petitions and vote and change the way that we spend our money, vote with your dollar, and so on. It's all very indirect. It's not direct at all. And so direct action is sort of an antidote to that. The idea is that, you know, rather than using these indirect methods, let's actually do it ourselves. Let's take action ourselves to meet our goals rather than relying on other people to do it for us. So based on that idea, we started putting together these trainings, and they've morphed and changed over the years as we've gained more experience with them. And I can say that in the beginning, I think that we took a little bit too much of our guidance from other direct action trainings that we had been a part of. I don't know about you or about the listeners, but I've been to lots of nonviolent direct action trainings that were, you know, a couple hours long, maybe something along those lines. And they always seemed to teach the same basic skills, which were useful, but somewhat limited. And over the years, we've kind of tried to expand this quite a bit in line with actually something that you were involved in, which is the Deep Green Resistance trainings that existed before the book came out. So I first went to a Deep Green Resistance training back in 2009, and it communicated a whole different way of looking at organizing and a much more militant revolutionary perspective. Derek, would you mind actually describing a little bit about those DGR trainings and what they were like?
Sure, I'd be glad to, except I'm wondering if before that you would mind, you said they would teach a set of tools at the trainings you went to, but could you say what some of those tools are? And could you say some of the, what you see as the successful parts of the direct action things that you were taught and some of the things that you thought could have been improved on?
Sure. So probably a lot of your listeners have had this experience where you go to a protest and it almost seems like things are scripted at this point. All the activists know what's going to happen, the cops know what's going to happen, and everyone just sort of plays the role that they've been assigned. So the activists show up and they do their march, they have their signs, they do their picket or what have you, and maybe a few people do some sort of blockade or lockdown or something along those lines. The cops walk right in, they arrest those people, and then everyone goes home. And a lot of the nonviolent direct action trainings that I have been to are all about sort of training people to play that role training people to fulfill that sort of idea of what a protest looks like. And so there will be trainings for interacting with the police and trainings for maintaining nonviolent discipline and legal support and all kinds of different things like this, maybe how to do some sort of nonviolent, simple blockade tactic. They're all useful skills, but I think that oftentimes they kind of get twisted. I think that sort of protest, a lot of people have the idea that that's sort of the prototypical direct action. But to me, it doesn't really get more symbolic than that. You really are trying to get media attention and convince other people to take action on your behalf. So it's not really even direct action when you get to that point, because you're not really directly achieving the goals that you want to achieve. What was the second part of the question again?
I think that was it. It was, what were the strengths of these trainings and what were the things that you think could have been improved on?
Yeah, exactly.
So there's one thing, though, about this. What would be the difference between, and you don't need to go here if you don't want to, but what would be the difference? I've heard a lot of sort of black bloc type anarchists complain that also that they are scripted, the protests are scripted, and to break that script, then they will break semi-random windows or throw rocks at cops. Is that what you're suggesting with direct action, which is okay if you are, or is that not what you're suggesting? It's okay if you're not.
No, not really.
Is that part of the scripting?
Not really. I think that we have to be clear that when I talk about breaking the script, it's not breaking the script just for the purposes of breaking the script. It's about doing so. Again, the point of direct action is to directly achieve your goals. So if your goal is to break some windows, then maybe that is a form of direct action under your strategy. But I'm not really interested in breaking windows that are 10 times out of 10 going to be insured by the corporations anyway, so they don't even lose any money when you break their windows. I think we need to be interested in more serious, more fundamental goals. Dismantling capitalism, dismantling corporate power, stopping the destructive projects that we're trying to fight, you know, pipelines, tar sands, all those things that I mentioned earlier. There are so many terrible things going on around the world. And I think that just because a tactic is more dangerous or is more risky, that doesn't mean that it is more useful or more effective. And I think that window smashing can be a good example of that. That's not to say that a person should never smash windows. That's not at all what I'm saying. I just think that similarly to how a lot of people think of direct action as the scripted, nonviolent, peaceful blockade, a lot of other people think about direct action as simply battling cops in the streets. And that's not necessarily effective. That's not to say, again, there's not a time for that, because, you know, that may be useful and strategically appropriate in certain circumstances. But direct action is, whether it's effective or not, really depends completely on the scenario that you're in the political circumstances, on the social circumstances that are happening in a specific place in a specific time.
Yeah, that, you know, when you're talking about this, I want to read something that Stephanie McMillan wrote several years ago that has always really struck with me about when people talk about, quote, diversity of tactics. And it's a fairly long thing. I'm going to read it and then have you respond to it. Saying you do or don't support a diversity of tactics is meaningless in the abstract. How many blog inches have been devoted to arguing about whether it's wrong or awesome or varying degrees of okay in which particular circumstances to break windows at a demonstration? How many conflicts among demonstrators have occurred between those who want to do it and those who want to prevent it from being done? By itself, the question is useless. Focusing on tactics misses the point. We can argue with each other for a million years whether property destruction is violence or not, whether voting is violence or not, and whether violence in the abstract is good, bad, or necessary evil. But it's all an empty debate if we avoid the main topic we should be discussing. What's it for? Action for action's sake is a stupid waste of time and energy. Everything we do should fit into an overall plan. A tactic cannot be judged outside its context. It should be a manifestation of a political line in harmony with a strategy that's consistency between its short-term and long-term aspects. It should serve some specific goal. If you argue for a tactic, then you should be able to explain how it gets us where we need to go. This shouldn't be vague, but worked out as a rational theory. Only with this understanding can the actual employment of this tactic and its results be judged as effective or not. To which I respond, that's as true of breaking windows as it is of holding signs, as it is of filing lawsuits, as it is of marching, as it is of fighting cops, as it is of writing books, as it is of any other action you could do.
Yeah, absolutely. That's beautiful. Stephanie is really brilliant.
Yeah. So it seems that's part, and that is a question. And I'm going to ask this question of the listeners. You can answer if you want, but I'm really asking this for listeners to think about this. Is like, think about the A to B. How does your marching in a protest or signing a petition or blockading yourself on a train track or whatever it is you're doing, how does that actually get you toward your goal? Which leads to another problem, which is I don't think most activists have even thought through the goals. I mean, what are the goals? I mean, that's really sorry to go on when it's your interview, but when, you know, this really hit me when I was a baby activist in the late 80s, early 90s more, where I saw all these environmental activists who were hanging on by their fingernails trying to protect this or that piece of ground, and they're so, rightly so intensely focused on protecting this or that piece of ground that they didn't have the luxury of asking, you know, why are these pieces of ground being destroyed in the first place? How do we ultimately save the salmon? They're trying to protect one piece of ground and, you know, the entire culture is destroying all the world. And so basically they were frontline troops. Basically they're trying to hold the line until civilization collapses. And many of them were very aware of this.
Yeah.
But anyway, so do you want to respond to anything in that long jumble?
Absolutely. So that's exactly why when we do these trainings, we start with an overview and a discussion of the global context that we're in, and we start by talking about grand strategy. Because if we don't have a big picture of what is happening, what's the context for our actions, and of our strategy and what we're trying to accomplish and how we think that could happen, then action is going to be worthless, like Stephanie said. And so, you know, of course, the context now, we have to help people to understand that our movements are not winning. We're not being very, very effective by and large. There is the occasional victory here and there, but if you look on the big picture at whatever issue, global warming, species extinctions, toxification, patriarchy, you know, white supremacy, all these different issues, they're generally heading in the wrong direction for the most part. And so given that global context, then we have to look at why is that happening, and we have to analyze what are the systems of power that we're operating under, what are the institutions that we're operating under, why is it that our so-called democracy is not allowing us to stop these things. And then we have to dive into grand strategy. And that involves taking a look at, you were just talking about all of these environmentalists defending these places, which, as you said, is the frontline work. It's very important. But one of our big focuses in these trainings is, let's take a step back and examine how many of our struggles are defensive. And anyone who has studied military strategy knows that you don't win a war by defense alone. In fact, if you're only doing defensive measures, then you're condemned to defeat. Even if you win, you know, 99 battles out of 100, you're still headed towards defeat. And we're losing a lot more than 99. We're losing a lot more than one out of every 100 battles. Probably the opposite, in fact. So we start with that big picture.
Just one thing real quick. Robert E. Lee was asked once why he so often attacked, even though he was often outnumbered 2-1. And he responded, "We must weigh the risk of action versus the positive loss of inaction." Anyway, go ahead. Which I wish everybody talked like that today, by the way.
Yeah, and that's the thing is with these direct action trainings, we have people come in and they've gotten the same messages that I got growing up as an activist and that so many of us get that, you know, that first we're told that nonviolent action and voting with your dollar are the way to go. And then a lot of people figure out that those things don't necessarily often work. And then people fixate on direct action. And we have to be the people who go into these communities. You know, people come to us, they're involved in a certain campaign, and they say, can we bring you out for a training? And we say, yes, we come out and we do a training. And we have to burst their bubble a little bit, honestly. We have to say to them, you know, direct action is not something that's going to solve every problem. It's not something that is a magic bullet that can just fix everything for you. And, you know, sometimes direct action can win a campaign, but that's often going to be the exception. I mean, look at Standing Rock, look at the Occupy movement, look at the WTO protests. I mean, these are all incredibly massive mobilizations of people and resources and all focused on direct action. And what we're seeing is maybe some tactical victories, some small victories, but at the strategic level, our movements are losing. All of these struggles were lost ultimately. And so we try and bring that perspective to people and explain that, you know, we need to change our whole conception of what direct action means, because if it only means this specific type of nonviolent protest that is pretty scripted, or if it only means window smashing, then we're condemning ourselves to defeat. And we have to understand that, you know, the history of direct action is basically the history of resistance movements around the world. So whether you're talking about, you know, John Brown, the Algerian liberation movements, the IRA, whether you're talking about, you know, the Black Panthers, the Deacons for Defense, the suffragists, all of these movements were built and centered around direct action. And it was a lot more diverse and strategic in many cases than the modern conception that people have.
Yeah, yeah. So would this be a good time to talk about the older, the DGR workshops that we used to do?
Sure.
So the DGR workshops would provide context for all of the destruction of the planet. There would be some, you know, history of the last 6,000 years of how civilization's been destroying the planet, and there would be discussions of the difference between the way liberals think and the way radicals think, and approaches between liberal versus radical. There would be a lot of history, a lot of sort of taxonomy of action discussions. And then the heart of it was a two-day program. The thing would last Friday night, Saturday, Sunday, until the afternoon or evening. And the heart of it was a simulation that we would put people through, a game where it would be the current day, and then Eric would stand in for the government, Lier would stand in for the natural world, and I would stand in for the general public. And then people in the group, the you know, 30, 40, 50 people, however many, would break into groups basically by proclivity. And you can correct me if my memory is wrong on these, but I believe they were separated into those who are making social change, those who are doing above ground like relocalization movements, those who are doing protesting, and those who are doing underground, single individual underground actions or small cell, and then also large-scale organized resistance. Do I have all the groups?
Yep, sounds right.
Okay, so they would break themselves into those groups by proclivity. Everybody goes to the group they want, and, you know, there might be one person in the organized militant resistance group, which is, of course, an oxymoron, but that's all right. And then we would play out scenarios. So what do you do? What's your first round of action? And so the group that's really interested in relocalization, I remember one time they built a Montessori school, and that's all great. And then, you know, the small cell group would do something else, would do some sort of action. And then after they all said their actions, the three of us would go through and we would say what the response by the government was. So if you build a Montessori school, the government doesn't really care. If you have a small group of people try to break into a military installation and steal all their guns, then Eric, as the government would say, well, you're all arrested, you're now in federal prison. We would give the government a response. Or if they didn't catch all of them, it'd be like, okay, so we're going to pass a law now saying that there's a curfew. You know, the government would respond, however the government would respond to that situation. And then the public would respond. They make a Montessori school. It's like, that's nice. They have pizza. They can have some pizza when I go over there. You know, it's like the public would respond. It was the public, I don't think, really. It's like, okay, maybe my kids like it, maybe not, whatever. Anyway, and then the land, it would be, Lear always had the final say, because the land always has the final say. And she would say, your Montessori school did absolutely nothing to help the planet. And that protest that you had over there, where everybody held their signs, it was great, and everybody, they took nice pictures, and it was in the newspaper. Biodiversity is still going down. Oceans are still getting worse. Carbon emissions are still going up. And we tried doing this program once in a 3-hour workshop, and it failed miserably. And the reason it failed is because it really took, the point of this whole process really was to break people's hearts. And what I mean by that was that when we look in the real world, our tactics aren't working. So in the simulation, we would have people filing timber sales, and then Eric would respond as the government did, which is to say, you know, your timber sales are slowing the cut, the rate at which timber is cut. So we decided we're going to pass a salvage rider, which means that timber sales are no longer susceptible to appeal. So we're going to cut all the trees. And the public response to that, when they came to me, it's like, what do you think about that? I don't care, whatever. Which was the public's response when they passed the salvage rider. And so it would, and this is of course something faced by every activist in the world, is I realized for sure in 1995 that any time we find a way to use the rules of the system to shut down the system, or to stop some destructive activity, to stop some injustice, those in power change the rules. And so the weekend would be spent doing that to the people, that basically more protests, more this, more that. We have 100,000 people get together and march in the streets of Washington, and all, end of the line, Lear says, biodiversity goes down. You didn't stop carbon emissions. And so somebody would break a whole bunch of windows, and biodiversity goes down. And the point was to, when we had them for a weekend and not just 3 hours, people would undergo that process of having their heart broken, as environmentalists go through that process of having their heart broken. And then toward the end, we would see more and more people drifting over to the organized militant resistance. And then we would also see that oftentimes the government did not like that and would arrest many of them. Eric would arrest them. And the general public didn't like it very much either, especially when they interrupted my ability to watch the Omni Super Bowl. The government was Omniv, and if they cut power during the Omni Bowl, man, I didn't like them at all.
Yep.
And so that's I hope that's enough of an introduction. So now if you can take it back to the current status and run with it, that'd be great.
Yeah, thank you for that. And those trainings were really great. And if anybody didn't get a chance to go to one of those who's listening to this program, I'd urge you to check out these direct action trainings, because we're trying to take that same model and apply it today. And yeah, there are, as you explained, there are really two different parts. The first one is disabusing people of their inaccurate ideas about what is going to be effective for making social change or stopping the murder of the planet. And the second one is giving people skills. And so just like at the Deep Green Resistance trainings that you used to run, these new trainings include discussions of security culture and target selection and scouting for action, taxonomy of action, a variety of different things like that, organizational structures, tools that will actually be useful to people. And my experience is that so often, I mean, just last year I went and did one of these trainings in Colorado, and this community called us in and they are facing fracking coming into their town. This was in Paonia, Colorado, which is a pretty small town, has a lot of small-scale organic agriculture, and it's a pretty rural area, generally conservative region, but they had this sort of small core group that was organizing to try and stop fracking from coming into the headwaters of their valley. And it was kind of heartbreaking to go there and see that place and see what was coming for them, and to help them understand that using the tools of the legal system, there is nothing that they can do to stop that fracking. You know, as Thomas Lindsay often says, sustainability is illegal. And he doesn't mean that metaphorically, he means it literally. It's illegal to make the sustainable choices in this society and in most societies around the world, because they're built on destruction, obviously. So it's kind of heartbreaking to take people through that process, but we have to do that. We have to have our bubbles burst before we can start to contemplate more effective types of action. And you know, it reminds me of, you mentioned that I grew up in Seattle in the intro, and it reminds me of 2003, February 2003, marching in the streets in Seattle against the invasion of Iraq. And I think that was the largest day of mass protest in world history. And I think it still is to this day, if I'm not mistaken. There were millions and millions of people all over the world. I mean, from basically every country in the world, there were these massive marches taking place simultaneously. And in Seattle, there were 50,000 people, and I was marching as part of this group. And I just remember the feeling of power marching with 50,000 other people through downtown Seattle. The feeling of power that that gave me as a teenager was incredible. And then I experienced the pain and the reality that our protest did nothing. The war went ahead, the invasion went ahead a few days or a few weeks later. And, you know, now look at the result. Millions of dead Iraqis, you know, refugees, the depleted uranium poisoning of places like Fallujah that are now going to be radioactive basically forever. And, you know, a lot of people look at things like the rise of the Islamic State and all these other groups and say that wouldn't have happened without the invasion of Iraq. So, I mean, literally just millions and millions of lives lost and untold ecological devastation and all the ramifications, you know, you could just go on down the list. And our protest did nothing to stop that. And that was a very, very important lesson to learn. So I think that's one of the most valuable things we can do with these trainings is help people to understand why what we are doing is not working and pave the way for considering more effective methods.
So I want to ask you two directions with this, and you can go either direction or both. One of them is, how do you deal in those action camps with the sorrow that you're throwing people through in a weekend that you and I dealt with over a longer period of time? And, or you can go, what are more effective means than a protest of millions of people all around the world?
Well, I'll take the second one first. And given that this is Deep Green Resistance, we talk about the same things that you wrote about with Eric and Lierre in the Deep Green Resistance book. And we especially focus on militant action, militant resistance against the industrial infrastructure. So, you know, for example, in this training in Colorado, we were explaining to people, you know, we can protest here, we can do nonviolent direct action blockades, we can petition the government, we can talk to politicians, we can make signs, we can do all these things, and they're very, very unlikely to make any difference. But if someone were to take out these supplies of frack sand that the fracking companies are completely dependent on, there are only a few places where they need a certain very particular type of sand, a certain mineral, and it can only be found in a few regions in the United States. I think is one of sort of inject it into their wells and make the frack. And if some sort of sabotage or the infrastructure that was necessary for that frack sand to be mined and then transported to where it needs to go, if that was halted, then fracking would become technically impossible to continue. And as you have said before very often, Derek, the way that you win any war is by removing the enemy's ability to wage that war. And we try to help people to understand that by going through a lot of examples of contemporary and historic resistance movements and specific actions, specific campaigns, both effective and not effective, and talk about what made them effective and what made them fail, if they did. So we'll talk about, for example, the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta, which, with a very small number of people and a small budget, at one point knocked out 40% of the oil export capacity of Nigeria, which is the largest oil producer in Africa and one of the largest in the world. And they did that using sabotage against the pipelines and the processing facilities, essentially. That's something that the environmental movement in the U.S. cannot even claim to come close to. I mean, the U.S. is now the leading oil producer in the world, and the environmental movement here has been unable to stop that, has been unable to stop increases in production, let alone knock it down by 40%. So we go through examples like that, and we talk about them in detail in these trainings to help lead people through this process.
As you're speaking, I keep thinking of the understanding. I'm guessing that a lot of people who are listening are going to object to the language of war and the language of the way you win a war is by destroying the enemy's capacity to wage war, because what's the war? And for me, one of the things that's important to realize is that when so many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And part of that process, for me, was to change my loyalty away from the system and to the natural world itself. And when I start to perceive the world from the perspective of the salmon, or from the perspective of the redwood trees, or from the perspective of the lampreys, then all of a sudden I do realize that there has actually been a war that's been going on for several thousand years against the world. And can you talk about the moving of people through that process when you do these action trainings?
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that I understand.
And talk about your process too.
Yeah, it's something that I understand deeply, because I came up in the anti-war movement. My grandfather was a conscientious objector during World War II, who then got involved with the Quakers. And so I grew up in this family that had a deep questioning of violence and war and imperialism as a foundational value. And so I really understand being profoundly uncomfortable with that language of war. And I think the reality of it is that we are in a war already, and it's not a choice that we have made. It's not something that we get to decide on, unfortunately. It's a reality that we either recognize or we choose to ignore. You know, if anyone doubts that we're in a war, you know, I would say talk to indigenous people, talk to people in the economic colonies and people who are working in sweatshops right now. Talk to the people who are on the front lines in Standing Rock or in Ferguson. You know, talk to the forests who are being clear cut. I just flew back from your event actually in Colorado a few days ago here to my home in Oregon, and the clear cuts in the western foothills of the Cascades as I was flying into the Willamette Valley, just out as far as the eye can see, is just a checkerboard of clear. You know, think about the orca whales that are starving to death in the Salish Sea, or whoever your local endangered species are, because unfortunately, wherever you live, there are probably endangered species who live very close to you or who should live close to you. Talk to them. Talk to the people who live on the small island nations that are being, you know, overrun by rising sea levels. I understand that the language of war is challenging to people. And I think in some ways it should be challenging. We shouldn't be comfortable with violence and with war. That means that we're good people and we hold good values in our hearts. But at the same time, I think we need to recognize, like I said, this is not a choice that we've made. This is a reality that we recognize or we ignore. And not only is this a war that's being waged against the natural world by civilization or the culture of empire or capitalism or white supremacy or patriarchy, however you want to define or whatever angle you want to take on this problem, I think it stems from the same root. It's not just a war, it's a total war, in that this war doesn't distinguish between military and non-military targets. You know, everything is fair game in this war, and that's what we're seeing playing out.
Well, the salmon certainly aren't a military target, and they are being wiped out.
Yep, absolutely.
They are pretty much the definition of a civilian target.
Yep. Yeah, one of my favorite quotes is from the musician Lauryn Hill, who said in one of her songs, or on one of her live albums, she said, "Fantasy is what people want, but reality is what they need." So that's a big focus in these trainings, is trying to help people understand the reality of where we're at. And that is a hard, challenging emotional process. And ultimately, it may just come down to people's character, because some people have the courage and the determination and the strength to face that reality and then decide what they're going to do with it. And other people just don't seem to have that ability for whatever reason. I mean, a lot of people have totally legitimate reasons that they can't be involved in resistance movements, at least not on the front line, but anyone can be involved at a support level. And, you know, that's huge. I mean, I was recently invited to go to the Philippines on behalf of DGR. They use the term, the archipelago there, as a decolonized term. And I was invited to go there for a couple weeks and do some trainings. And I think that's a great example of where support is useful, because I'm going to have to buy a plane ticket. I'm going to have to get there. I'm going to have to take time off work. And it's going to take a lot of support to get me there. And all of these trainings, you know, we ask for donations and we ask for people to help bring people out, because we need to travel. We need to purchase supplies. So people can donate. People can help us promote these trainings. People can help bring us to their community. There are a lot of different ways to contribute, even if you can't be on the front lines.
All this time today you've been talking, I've been thinking about something that Thomas Lindsay of CELDF told me, that one of the things, and he said this in public, so I don't mind saying this, that one of the things that CELDF does is go into a community and give them the legal tools, help them with the legal tools to try to prevent a corporate hog factory from coming in or try to prevent fracking. And so often they give them these legal tools and then the fracking still goes on, the corporate hog farm still goes in, and although sometimes they win, oftentimes they lose. And so I asked him, you know, why do you do this when so often, I mean, apart from the fact that it's the right thing, why do you do this when so often you lose? And he said that there is no better way to make a revolutionary cadre than to go in, give people who believe that we live in a democracy the tools to put democracy in place, and then to see them to see the full might of the government and corporations combined come down on them and stop them from implementing democracy in their own communities. He said that's, you know, you get people who believe we have a democracy, you show them, you walk them through the processes, and you help them through the processes, and then they get stomped on. That's a really good way to help some of them at least move to the next level of understanding. You know, I was already getting it quite a lot, but one of the things that really helped radicalize me was the salvage rider. You know, I had worked on so many tens and hundreds of thousands of acres protecting them from chainsaws, and every one of those acres was cut as soon as they passed the salvage rider in 1995, under a Democratic president, by the way. And it just, I was already really radicalized at that point, but it radicalized me even further.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think that is always one of my main goals with these trainings, is that if you look through history, revolutionary movements and liberation struggles don't just emerge fully formed out of a vacuum. They generally arise and succeed, if they do succeed, because people train, they prepare, they plan, they organize, often for decades before the actual revolution is carried out. And so then when there is some sort of break in normality, or there's some sort of opportunity for change, for revolutionary change, people are ready. People are prepared. They're prepared sort of intellectually and theoretically. They understand what they're trying to do and why, and what the barriers are, and why the approved societal methods of change aren't going to work. But they're also prepared just in terms of literally having the skills necessary, having the organizational networks built, having organized resources, and actual organizations, groups formed to take advantage of these things. So that's one of our main goals with these trainings, is to be prepared, to be trained, to find those revolutionary cadre who can take the lead when situations do arise.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about, you know, the necessity of initiative. You know, one of the 9 principles of war, which is generally accepted in militaries around the world, is initiative. And if we can't take the initiative and be prepared, then we're not going to be effective in any conflict. And if we are planning to get arrested on purpose, as most direct action seems to entail these days, then we're often giving up the initiative. It's hard to organize when you're in jail. You've got legal fees, you've got lawyers to deal with, you're going to have to do a lot of fundraising. And so we're trying to bring a whole different perspective to that. And unfortunately, it's not an instant gratification perspective. This is a long-term struggle. As much as I wish that we were going to win tomorrow, that's probably not going to happen. So we've got to train people, we've got to prepare, we've got to invest in building organizations for success in the longer term.
You know, I'm thinking 3 things. One of them is the statement, Waterloo was won on the fields of Eton. And what that means is that the generals and the officers who fought at Waterloo started by with sports in Eton, and they started the training took years, and that's true for, you know, military officers everywhere, and for revolutionary leaders too. And then the second one is the beginning of the movie, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, which is about Irish resistance against the British occupation. It begins with a bunch of Irish guys playing hurling, the sport. And at first, it's like, what the hell? Why? It's like, that's like starting a World War II movie showing some guys playing basketball. You know, what's the point? But that's an ignorant perspective, because the Gaelic Youth League, I believe, was the predecessor of the IRB, which was a predecessor of the IRA. And the point is that through the sports, through a traditionally Gaelic, not a British sport, but a Gaelic sport, they were both learning their own history, they were changing their identification away from the British to the Irish, and they were also learning how to work together and getting in good shape. And this was, you know, decades before the other. But that's where the people who created the movie did a really good thing with that I didn't understand when I first saw it. And then the third thing is, a lot of people got really excited with Arab Spring. And it's like, oh, wow, it's so great. See, all you need to do now is put a bunch of posts on Facebook and get 100,000 people to gather, and everything's going to be great. But then I think, and Ramsey Kanaan said there's a big distinction between mobilizing and organizing. And Facebook can be great for mobilizing, but it's crap for organizing, which takes hard work. And so with Arab Spring in Egypt, for example, everybody's, yay, yay, democracy, wonderful, wonderful. And then who were actually the winners of the first round? That was the Muslim Brotherhood, which had been organizing since the 20s at least, doing hard work of organizing, waiting for the moment. And then actually who won the second round was the Western-backed military with the new dictatorship. So Arab Spring in Egypt was not a victory for Facebook. It actually shows that what you need is long-term organizing and long-term capacity. I don't know. Take any of that where you wish.
Yeah, absolutely. And with these trainings, I look at them as partly an organizing opportunity. It's a way to travel and meet people, build new relationships, and identify those people who are most committed and most ready to step up at some level into the struggle and take some sort of leadership role. And it always ends up being a two-way process. I feel like I learn a lot every time I participate in teaching one of these trainings. I learn a lot about their local struggle, about the fight that they've engaged in, and how it has played out on the ground. So yeah, I think that's absolutely the case, that there is a big difference between organizing and mobilizing. And one of the definitions that I teach in these trainings is that a simple definition of organizing is that organizing equals organized people plus organized resources. And an expansion of that definition would be that effective organizing involves doing action. You know, you always have to be maintaining relationships, because, again, to go back to Stephanie McMillan, she has a brilliant comic that says every revolution begins with two people talking. And I think that's a critical message. And we need to learn. We can't be stuck in our ways and just always be inflexible or dogmatic. We always need to be learning and adapting to the circumstances that we find ourselves in. And then action, because if you are just, you know, an armchair general and you're not connected to struggle directly in any way, then I think that you can start to lose touch in some ways with what's happening on the ground. And action is a great way to bring people together. Even if it's not necessarily the most effective thing in the moment, you can use action as an organizing tool, again, building for the long term. You can use action as a tool to bring people together and build and strengthen those bonds.
So let's say we've got just a couple of minutes left. Let's say that I am name a state, Max.
Kentucky.
You're in Kentucky, and you care about Eastern Kentucky and you care about a species of endangered ladybug. I just learned that there are many species of ladybugs who are highly endangered. You care about a species of endangered ladybug, or you are opposed to some fracking going on in the state, or you're opposed to some mountaintop removal in the eastern end, whatever. You want for the place to be as beautiful and wonderful as it used to be. And you would like to bring you for one of these direct action trainings. What do they require? What should they do?
Well, the first step will be to contact me. You can reach me at training at deepgreen. That will get to me. You can also find me on Facebook.
It crapped out right when you said it.
The email address is training@deepgreenresistance.org. And okay. I'm also on Facebook and Twitter, and I have a website. You can contact me via any of those methods. And we can open up a conversation. But these trainings are pretty easy to put together. I think it's a great way for somebody to gain experience in organizing, to help put together a training like this, because being able to organize an event is just a fundamental skill for any organizer, I think. Generally, they're 2 to 4 day trainings. They can be more or less. We've done them as short as 5 hours and as long as a week. And the costs, we generally keep it really low. We're not interested in making money. So the costs are generally getting a few trainers to the location, so whatever travel costs are involved in that. Often, if we're going to be eating together, then food, housing if it's necessary. But these can be done for a relatively low amount of money, and we can help with fundraising for sure. So if anyone is interested in making a training like this happen, just reach out and we can start a conversation about it. And I would really love to help make that happen for anyone.
Okay, great. Well, before we end, I just want to say that Max is one of the best activists in the world. Anyway, I would like
too
to
kind.
Thank you for being on the program. I'd like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Max Wilbert, one of the best activists in the world. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Thanks, Derek.